From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In a letter written in 1816, Thomas Jefferson remarks that if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Jefferson's comment underscores two ongoing activities under the aegis of the National Endowment for the Humanities, an independent federal agency, the Jefferson Lecture and the Endowment's Office of Preservation. Both are subjects on this week's edition of Soundings. First, excerpts from a conversation with Cleanth Brooks of Yale University, selected by the National Endowment for the Humanities to deliver the 1985 Jefferson Lecture. Following that, a discussion with Harold Cannon, the director of the Endowment's Office of Preservation. The Jefferson Lecture originated in 1972. It's the highest honor conferred by the government for outstanding achievement in the humanities, citing the combination of intellectual and civic virtues exemplified by Thomas Jefferson. Cleanth Brooks entitled his 1985 Jefferson Lecture, "The Literature in a Technological Age." I talked with Cleanth Brooks the day following his Jefferson Lecture and asked him to comment on his choice of topics.
Well, it's hard to describe. We've got probably more poets writing today, poets and would-be poets. Some of them are pretty good. Mm-hmm. We've got a vast number of novelists writing. We've got a lot of young dramatists. It's not that quantity is out, nor even all quality. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have a vast part of our population that knows nothing about these people, to the extent that there's a jest, rather cruel jest, but it has point, that the young poets write mostly for each other. Public doesn't know anything about them, doesn't read any. Mm-hmm. It's one of these strange oil and water businesses where all the oil is at the top and all the water is at the bottom, because there's much more water than oil in this particular compound.
But is Cleanth Brooks's oil and water metaphor describing the tensions between the general public and a literary community that many observers see talking mainly to itself fair to both sides? Are there other sides to the issue, a middle ground, or is one left only with the choice of being a populist or an elitist?
I am an elitist only in the sense I want the best, but not in the sense that I want to exclude anybody from the best, as nearly as he can or she can come to the best. Therefore, in a democracy, a person interested in the well-being of the Republic of Letters, I would like to see everybody, as far as he or she can, participate in good literature.
According to Cleanth Brooks, one of the charges frequently leveled at the literary specialists has some merit. The problem of the bewildering complexity, some would charge deliberate obscurity, of the jargon that characterizes much literary discourse today. Related to this is the problem of sorting out the proper role of the literary critic in contemporary American letters. Is he or she an active creative participant, or a sideline observer who should be content to comment upon rather than shape the rules that govern the interpretation and teaching of American literature, past and present? Cleanth Brooks.
My own experience tells me, as I read the learned monographs and articles by people who are PhDs and who some of whom have post in reputable colleges and universities, I think a lot of useless literary criticism, with quotation marks around literary criticism, is being written. I would gather from that teaching can't be too good. So my impression is that all is not well, but I can't prove it. If you're dealing with words and what words are and how they work and their points of reference, you may have to get into some pretty subtle points at which you can't expect the ordinary citizen to follow you. Just as, to use an analogy, powered physicist may have to use some very technical language of his own. I'm not saying it's all wrong just because it's technical. What does worry me, however, is that a great deal of it seems to me off the point at the moment.
And what might that be?
Well, If the deconstructionist, I can't understand them, I'm going to try again, I can't understand them thus far because they do use such a peculiar jargon, but if they're correct, and if words don't really have any relation to reality, then I think that's pretty bad for literature. Why should I have spent 50 years simply playing an elaborate game with words with my students? How is one going to say it in 15 minutes or even in a small book? Except to say that, to me, granted that fiction is fiction and is not sociology or history, still, unless our words have some kind of relation to the things out there in the world and the things inside our heads, I can't see that the game would make much sense. We read for wisdom, we read for amusement, we read for pleasure, we read to learn past history, and all of these are relevant. I was arguing last night, if you heard my lecture, that there is a certain wisdom that we can learn something about ourselves and our world by observing how people acted and reacted to each other, to their own innermost drives, to the world around them. Even if they're fictional, Hamlet can tell us something about human nature. Sigmund Freud thought that Oedipus, that mythical creature, mythical hero, could tell us something about the human psyche. There's no reason, it seems to me, that the world of the imagination doesn't make contact with the world of reality at some level. If it doesn't, then again, I see no point in playing that game. I'm not interested in it.
According to Cleanth Brooks, yet another tangle in addressing the function and direction of literature in a technological society lies in figuring out whether literature and the humanities should be problem solvers in American culture.
Well, I'm not sure at all that the humanities can solve it. As I indicated last night in my lecture, I think Matthew Arnold was wrong in thinking literature could take the place of philosophy and religion. I think they are ultimates. On the other hand, it can do a great deal, and I think that our age in particular ought to heed what it can do. Literature can, for one thing, cultivate our imaginations. It can help us to put ourselves in the place of somebody else, with a different color of skin, with a different cultural background, with a different income, and so on. In fact, as early as the 18th century and maybe earlier, one of the things which literature was praised for was that it begot tolerance of other people. It took us out of our own little coops of space and time in which we lived and made us live in an ampler world through our imaginations. If we see that that very important task is done superbly by the great poets, then we may come to a greater respect for them. If you want to say, all right, yes, but I want to see some of those problems solved. Though we've had a lot of debate among the philosophers of whether they've ever solved them and which one solved them. But yeah, let's turn then to philosophy. But in the meantime, how poverty-stricken philosophy would be if we didn't have great poetry. Let me use an analogy. I don't want to dodge the question. Literature and literary criticism and literary teaching is not an ointment you can rub on the skin. It's like learning to play football or tennis. You got to exercise those muscles. And if you can learn how to exercise the imagination so that language becomes rich for you and precise, in which human motivation, you can articulate it up to a point at least. If you can do those things, then you are ready. Whether you've read any Shakespeare before or not, let's hope you have, but if you haven't, you can probably find that Macbeth is a rattling good murder story and better. We've got plenty of great literature in our own day to look at, absorb, really digest, learn from. So we're not without the resources. They're there, but they're locked up for much of the population, unless the population learns how to read them. It's not no good in putting William Faulkner's Light in August on the shelf, telling the student to read it. If he's going to take it as merely a book, another book on race relations, it's that, but it's something much more. Or a piece of sociology. This is the way North Mississippi is. He's got to learn how to read a novel. If he can, then it's unlocked for him.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to excerpts from a conversation with Cleanth Brooks of Yale University. Cleanth Brooks delivered the 1985 Jefferson Lecture under the sponsorship of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Soundings concludes now with a conversation about another aspect of cultural activity underway at the Humanities Endowment. This is the Endowment's Office of Preservation, directed by Harold Cannon. Harold Cannon, our topic is preservation, scholarly materials, materials that scholars use in the humanities. You run the Office of Preservation at the National Endowment for the Humanities. How many books are at risk? We have, I've read that we have about 250 research libraries in the United States. What about the holdings? What percentage are you worried about?
Well, our estimate is that something between 25 and 30% are currently at risk, and mm-hmm. that means an approximate figure of 75 million books.
Now, these are books that stand just literally to fall apart.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
They're on the library shelves. It's of course, a silent problem. Unless the book is called up by a user, by a scholar, even the librarian may not be aware of the, right. the state of that particular volume.
Right.
Now, there'll be duplicates within that figure of 75 million, of course. The interesting thing is that no matter how many copies of the book survive, they must inevitably, sooner or later, all crumble into dust, mm-hmm. no matter mm-hmm. how well kept they're being at the moment.
What about microfilming? Hasn't that offset some of the problem, or is there an irony here that we're unaware of?
Well, of course, microfilming seems to be the best answer where the intellectual content is what you want to preserve, in other words, the print itself. Let me give you some numbers there, however. Our count is, now that we have a national database, National Microform Masters, as it's called, our count is that only something between 150 and 200,000 volumes per year are currently being microfilmed.
You say only?
Only.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you match that up with the 75 million volumes that are at risk,
I see.
You see, you can do that arithmetic in your head better than I can, I would imagine. It's a very tiny proportion. If, for example, we estimate that we're saving 1%, of what needs to be saved, we'd be talking about more like 750,000, and that is, what, a quadrupling of the present effort.
Mm-hmm.
And this in a way goes back to the reason for this new Office of Preservation at the Endowment. It is, of course, a budgetary item, and one of the things it will mean if we get our request level for next year, the money that we're asking for, is that we will, between this year and next, more than double the amount of funding that we can put into mm-hmm. this considerable effort around, mm-hmm. around the nation.
Harold Cannon, you run the Office of Preservation at the National Endowment for the Humanities. How do you intend to implement this task? It is immense, going into the nation's libraries, first of all, in a statistical sense, figuring out what needs to be saved or preserved, and then later we can talk about the more difficult question of what gets saved and how those decisions are made.
Well, we get a lot of help from our friends, is the typical answer
right.
there is. We've been in the business of funding preservation efforts in research libraries for about 8 years now. This
uh-huh.
is not a novelty for us by any means, although it's been a much smaller activity in relation to other things in the budget. This has enabled us to do quite a lot of exploratory work, or rather to help others to do it for us, to hold meetings, to do a certain amount of training, to increase the awareness of librarians and other curators as to what the extent of the problem is, and to fund actual shelf surveys mm-hmm. to go through a collection volume by volume and check it out, which we've done at Stanford University and at Yale University. And this, plus the sort of national impetus of an institution like the Library of Congress, which is very much a leader in this whole preservation area, we've got a good deal of information, and the profession, if you like to put it that way, is ready to go, we feel, and so we're ready to help them along as best we can.
Harold Cannon, what about the question of what gets saved? Are there going to be territorial battles there among and between the various scholarly disciplines, or do you feel that scholarship as an institution just is going to endorse this process of preserving books?
I can't conceive of there being actual squabbles yet, because I don't think there's sufficient awareness of the problem, even in the scholarly community. I think where a scholar has tried to gain access to materials, has been told by a librarian that those materials are no longer available, there may be a sense of frustration, and he will go to another library or another source. He may not always know that that collection is no longer available simply because it's been queued for microfilming and therefore cannot be handled by anybody.
But in a way, this is the way you're going to get some of your answers, isn't it? Scholars telling the librarians, who in turn will tell you people at the Office of Preservation, that here's something that is, as you say, at risk.
That's right. Most research librarians will have to rely on a call card coming in from whatever source to indicate that this book is needed for scholarship now, and then as the staff in the library prepare the volume for the user, they should at some stage notice what its condition is before they hand it over, and that's when queuing for microfilm is often the route taken. That's one of the methods of selection. The degree of selectivity is such that if I mentioned the possibility of saving 1% of the books that are at risk at the moment, if we had, if you like, all the money that we could possibly use in this area, I don't think we could save more than perhaps 3% of what is at risk. It's perhaps just as well, therefore, that we're not involved in this internecine warfare between departments. The other method, and so far we have one example of this, the other method of going at the problem of selection, of course, is to ask a group of scholars that represent a body of a scholarship, a scholarly association, for example, to consider standard bibliographic works and to go down those lists with a pencil and check off the ones that they consider to be the most valuable, with the approximate idea that only perhaps one volume in 20 or one in 30 can be saved. And we have such a grant to the American Philological Association, and they're just beginning their work this summer. They've taken a first cut at what they would like to have saved. And one of the interesting things to me is that just over 50% of what they have marked for saving so far has in fact proved to be reprinted, which is a very good indication that they're picking out the right works, because if the publishing people feel that these are works that deserve reprinting and have a market, they probably are the most valuable ones as far as the scholars are concerned.
Harold Cannon, our topic is the preservation of materials for scholars. You are the director of the Office of Preservation at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Ideally, what would be the effect of this this immense project? What gets saved? How does it affect, to use a very large term, our cultural heritage? Is that part of the goal here?
Yes, indeed it is. If you think about the books that are in the worst possible condition at the moment, they'll probably fall somewhere between 1870 and 1920. And many of our present grants are targeted on that, on books published in that particular period. If you think about when the graduate university system first started up in this country, which was probably, what, in the 1880s, American scholarship really began to flower in the final decades of the 19th century. Therefore, there is, what, 50 years, perhaps, of American scholarship, which could be decimated, consigned to oblivion, or whatever other dramatic phrase you want to use for it. Now, a good deal of that work, of course, probably we could say will go with no regrets. But the difficulty is that since in the humanities particularly, so much of our work is cumulative, it's also true to say that we really can't afford to lose any of it, because we don't know when it's going to be valuable or when a scholar will come along who's going to be interested in a particular slant or a particular approach to a certain topic. And it may well be that what we're doing here is working not so much for the present generation of scholars as for the next or the one after that.
Let me ask you to elaborate on that, Harold Cannon. You run the Office of Preservation at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Be specific for me. What kinds of things might get saved? Now, we're talking, for instance, Frank Norris writes a novel, and then some scholars come along and write about that novel. And then there are scholars who comment on the scholars. What various levels here are you looking to preserve?
Well, I don't think the original work, especially since you cite, for example, a work of fiction by Frank Norris, that in itself probably is not at risk, because if this is an author of some significance, probability is he's been reprinted and republished many times over, and there are thousands and thousands of copies out there. It is very much the secondary work. It is the monograph, which is the typical product of humanities research work, that is at risk here. I was asked just last week in Iowa what I would do for a first edition of Mark Twain, and I said, well, as far as the office is concerned, it may sound callous, but probably nothing much, because a first edition of Mark Twain has a commercial value, and it'll probably take care of itself quite nicely without the endowment helping. But if we have a book that exists only in 20 copies of a monograph written, say, in 1910 on Huckleberry Finn, and we know we have only those few copies and they're all in desperate condition, then I think microfilming one copy of that would be a very high priority for us, much higher than that first edition of Mark Twain.
Well, again, to extend that, what will you not consider for funding in this effort to preserve the documents that scholars need?
That's a very hard question to answer, because I think at the moment our doors are wide open. They have to be, because of course the endowment, as you know, in all its funding guises, runs an intensely competitive business. And as I'm fond of telling program officers, we always have to have, somewhat cynically, we always have to have proposals to turn down. So we extend our arms gratefully to all applications and to all applicants. We try to give them preliminary advice as a staff about what is most likely to be a high priority and what's most likely to succeed. But in many cases, there probably will be a good many that we will turn down. Now, what kind will they consist of? I don't think it will be so much the work itself, because if anyone, and by that I mean a scholar or a librarian, says this is something that should be saved, then it is very difficult to argue with that viewpoint. Where we're likely to turn down a proposal that builds in such a conservation of a particular item is if it does not guarantee access on a national basis. In other words, if there's not provision for entering a full bibliographic record of this saving exercise into a national database that other people can use, then we'll get duplication and the whole thing would be a wasted effort. Let me give you the economics of that. It costs about $60 to microfilm a 300-page book. And that includes the entry into the database that I just mentioned, as well as the literal page turning and taking of the photographs. Once you've done that and you've got a master, it costs about $2 to make a copy of that book. It's obviously to everyone's advantage not to do the original microfilming, but to wait until somebody else has done it and to order a copy. But we can't afford duplication, because it's such an expensive process that everyone needs to know, even if a book is being lined up for microfilming. Because many institutions now tell us that they have backlogs, and that is probably the first priority that we will get into. Institutions that already know that this is a book that is needed for use, that it is in bad condition, they've queued it for microfilm, they've indicated in the national database that it is Columbia University Library that has queued this for microfilming, therefore no other institution in the country need do this. Well, the sooner it gets microfilmed, the better. And maybe our grant will help that to come to be.
Harold Cannon, you run the Office of Preservation at the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're talking about the preservation of documents that scholars use in the universities principally. But this is tax money. What do you say to the citizen who says, wait a minute, you shouldn't be spending this money on saving all this arcana, all this stuff that doesn't really affect the way I live? Is there an answer to that rather harsh sort of charge or criticism?
Well, to change the old proverb, I suppose one man's arcana is another man's meat. My usual answer in this area, as in the humanities generally, is to say to such a person, you may not be interested in it, but your son or your granddaughter may very well be interested in it. If we're a nation that cares about our cultural heritage at all, then surely some fraction of our public funds should be invested into a cause of this sort. It's an index, I believe, and this is a personal statement, of course, it's an index, I believe, of what a society at large values, and I think that's what underlay the legislation that founded the endowment 20 years ago.
What is it, to sort of flip that question over, Harold Cannon, what is it that the ordinary citizen might do to advance this cause? Somebody who has no particular interest in humanities or humanities scholarship, but who's aware of it and who sympathizes with it. Are there steps that can be taken there, or is it pretty much the area of the scholars and the librarians and the National Endowment for the Humanities?
No, I think it's not confined to scholarship at all, although that's where my starting point is, perhaps because of my own bias and my own background. a fair component of our new Office of Preservation, represented by perhaps 25 to 35% of its funding at the moment, will go on the U.S. newspapers project. And the preservation of old newspapers is of interest to a very wide group indeed. If you start with genealogists, for example, and include local historians or people simply interested in local history. And who is not interested in local history since the 76 bicentennial? I mean, there's been a tremendous upsurge of general interest in that topic. These old newspapers are the prime tool for American local history, as well as American history generally. And we launched this in 77, and we now have 22 states and territories working with the Library of Congress on a national database. The first processes are bibliographic. They're locating old copies of newspapers. They're literally visiting homes, going into attics, finding where the old newspapers are, and discovering what needs to be preserved. They're trying to avoid duplication through use of the database. And eventually, of course, at phase three, as we call it, of our funding, they will be microfilming and letting everybody else know where the microfilms are and where copies can be had. And this is going to be an enormous and very exciting resource. It's also a series of grants that will probably take us well into the 21st century because it's a very long-term business. It'll take us another 20 years, I should think, to get through all the parts of the country.
And who is this going to be made available to? Citizens can walk in off the street and go to libraries. And I read someplace that you have about, there are 2,000 terminals.
That's right.
That one could use to tap into all of this material.
What librarians refer to familiarly as the OCLC network, that Ohio group. Nearly all libraries, including public libraries as well as small college libraries, have a terminal of that sort, so that people can literally walk in off the street and ask a question that could be answered best perhaps by a local newspaper, and they can call it up on the screen and find out where the newspaper is, where it's available, how they could get hold of a copy, and so forth. So this information is currently being fed in to the CONSER database, which is the one organized by the Library of Congress, and is generally available. So this is certainly an arena where more than scholars are being served. One of the things, however, we have to remember is that along with this awareness of the retrospective problem in libraries has come a new awareness of what we need to do in order to tackle the prospective problem. And as a result of this, a very high proportion, probably 90% of the scholarly books being published in this country at the moment, this is a very high number as everybody knows, are being published on acid-free paper and conform to national permanent standards, so that no one need fear that the Library of the Future is going to consist entirely of microfiche. Books are going to be around.
And we're not going to walk in and meet Hal in 2000 and whatever.
That's right. Even if libraries become much more automated, which is something that some librarians have written about and talked about a good deal in recent years, it does seem to me that one of the implications of that may be the resurgence of the individual or even the private library. But I have no doubt about the fact that there'll be plenty of books around 100 and 200 years from now, because it's an article of pride with me. The endowment is helping to make that the case.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion with Harold Cannon, Director of the Office of Preservation at the National Endowment for the Humanities. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the Endowment's Jefferson Lecture and Office of Preservation, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of discussions about religion and theology. My guests will be William Bousma of the University of California at Berkeley and William Rowe of Purdue University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for discussions about ongoing cultural activities at the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Jefferson Lecture, and the Endowment's Office of Preservation. Thomas Jefferson commented that if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. That remark underscores my conversations this week with Cleanth Brooks of Yale University, the 1985 Jefferson Lecturer, and with Harold Cannon, the Director of the Office of Preservation at the Humanities Endowment. Literature and Preservation, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.